This case, as the court is likely aware, is an appeal of an order granting receivership under 11.402B of the Texas Business Organizations Code, which is a rehabilitative receivership. And it's important for the court to understand that there's two entities here. By the way, Chris Stoba on behalf of XR5 and Skull Creek Corporation. These two entities are in a receivership currently, but they get there somewhat differently. The appellees are limited partners of XR5, which is a limited partnership whose business is the operation of a disposal well. And Skull Creek is owned 100% by the largest shareholder of XR5, Ray Kelly. And Skull Creek has the most significant asset of Skull Creek is a parcel of property that is approximately 25 acres large. The well sits on XR5's well, and its equipment sits on a roughly 4-acre separately platted piece of property that is Skull Creek's property.
But not separately deeded.
It is not separately deeded. It is separately platted, however. So the appellees moved for receivership under 11.402B, rehabilitative receivership. And according to 11.402B, any applicant for a receivership moving to for a receivership to rehabilitate a domestic entity, there's certain conditions that first must be met in order for a person to move for a receivership, and then a court may appoint a receiver over either specific or all of the assets of an entity if certain statutory prerequisites are met. Court's already up to speed.
You're on page 5.
Okay. I'm not reading from the brief. So let me see. In any event, our problem is with respect to Skull Creek. First, Skull Creek, the appellees do not have an interest in Skull Creek. They're not owners. They're not members. They're not creditors. So we are taking the position that they don't even have standing to be asking for a receivership over Skull Creek. Second, under the holdings of several of the cases that we've cited, most notably Humble.
Skull Creek owns the well?
Skull Creek does not own the well, Your Honor.
The partnership owns the well on the land?
Yes, sir.
Not just operates it, but owns the well.
The partnership, the well and the equipment that is associated with the well is partnership property, clearly. But our problem is with respect to Skull Creek and the receivership order that was granted is that it's overbroad in under the holdings of Humble, several of the other opinions that we've cited, Fortenberry. That's with respect to Skull Creek.
Are there assets of Skull Creek other than the property?
The answer to that question is yes, but I'm not certain as to the extent of those. One of the problems that we have with the order that was eventually entered is it's not just limited to land. It talks about computer equipment. It talks about bank accounts, PO boxes. It talks about property that is possessed by Skull Creek merely, and Mr. Kelly has got construction trailers parked on it. It's a, you know, fenced-in piece of property that's got a stock tank on it. It's he cuts hay on it. There's a barn on it. According to the you know, reading of the order that was entered, all of that stuff is now something that is subject to a receivership.
All right. I understand. Your first position is that the appellees are either owners, members, or creditors of Skull Creek.
Correct.
Right. Now, what about the equity? What about traditionally a situation like this where a receiver can be appointed outside of those requirements? You just talked about owner, member, or creditor.
Well, are we talking about with respect to Skull Creek or XR5?
We're just talking about Skull Creek. You're talking about Skull Creek. I'm talking about Skull Creek.
Okay.
You're just complaining about Skull Creek.
Right. I looked through the case law. There's only one case that I was able to find, and it was brought to my attention actually by the appellees, which is this court's opinion in MIMS, which is the only example that I can find where and that isn't to say that maybe it's not out there, but I looked and was unable to find a single example of a court in any capacity upholding an order for receivership over real property, under that third exception or that third condition, which is the traditional appointment of a receiver. I haven't found any case out there that suggests that a parcel of property. I also contend that at a minimum the order granting the receivership over Skull Creek's property should have been more narrowly tailored, and that it is I don't think that it is equitable, whether that's traditionally or otherwise, to grant a receivership over property that's five times larger than is necessary to protect an applicant's interests in the property. I just am not sure that I'll ever find that case either, Your Honor. Excuse me, I just need to get a quick sip of water. Thanks. So that's with respect to Skull Creek. XR5, we have the same similar problems, or we do have similar problems, and that is, one, it's under the holding in Humble, the order is overbroad.
And we're not talking about standing now.
Nope.
Well,
that's with respect to XR5, and then specifically that the record, that there's no evidence in the record at all that suggests that the appellees at any time attempted to comply with 11.404B, which is that the three mandatory statutory prerequisites that must be shown in order for a receivership order to be upheld, and that is that circumstances exist that are considered by the court to necessitate the appointment of a receiver and to avoid damage to interested parties. Second, that all other requirements of law are complied with, and three, most importantly, because it applies both to XR5 and Skull Creek, that lesser that other available, and by that we would urge lesser, legal and equitable remedies, including the appointment of a receiver for specific property of the domestic entity under Section 11.402, are inadequate.
So exactly what are you suggesting? Let's assume that all of the allegations put forth by the appellees are true. What lesser remedies, what are you suggesting?
And the case law is replete with examples of, you know, monetary damages would have been one, injunctive relief was another. I mean, appellees certainly were not afraid. And in one case, I'm sorry, right. And in one case, there was, you know, where are the discovery? You know, you could have attempted discovery to potentially fashion a remedy that is not as harsh as a receivership. And appellees were not afraid at all to request injunctive relief from Judge Fostell. It was. They enjoined Mr. Kelly and all of his counsel from filing bankruptcy after, at the hearing, we got into discussion of the...
That was a new one on me. I didn't know you could do
that. But neither did I, Your Honor. And then and then at the hearing itself, after, you know, we got into the discussion of bankruptcy and the fact that there had been a petition filed in bankruptcy, we got into the discussion of, whether or not to extend that TRO. They moved the court to extend it, and it was extended. I mean, so, you know, I don't know what all else could have been the case. What I do know is that the case law, you know, is each and every single case discussing 11.404B says that it is absolute mandatory prerequisite. You have to show that that other remedies, either at law or equity, are inadequate.
All right. So your lead dog arguments are with respect to school free, no standing, and it's overly broad because it contains all 25 acres instead of the 4 acres.
Yes, Your Honor, but I would like to say that there it's worse than that. Under 11.404B, it's not just that they have to show that there are other remedies that are, you know, unavailable. It's that they have to show all three requirements. One, circumstances exist, and so it's all three.
Focusing on the third requirement.
Okay. Your Honor,
the court determines that all of other available legal and technical remedies, et cetera, are inadequate. Is that their burden? Seems like.
Yes, Your Honor, it is their burden, and the case law is absolutely clear on this. And that's.
I don't see how that's possible. I could probably come up, and I would think a lot of people have difficulty coming up with every other possible remedy that might be out there, and then you're trying to prove a negative. The show wouldn't work. Well, that doesn't sound reasonable.
And I understand that. But what the case law does show is that the times where an applicant says, "Listen, Your Honor, we believe that a receivership is necessary over, especially when you're dealing with one in the case law that is all assets and the business of an entity, they, as distinguished from, you know, just specific property, you know, you have an obligation according to the case law that says you must prove." And the way they do that is they go to the court and they say, we've tried discovery. We've tried an injunction won't work, and here's why. Money damages won't work, and here's why. And those are the ones that pass. I mean, it, as long as it's in the record, it has to be in the record. And
I don't see how money damages or injunction would work on an ongoing business of this nature.
I can see where it's conceptually it's. I'm sorry.
I don't recall that you suggested things that were adequate.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Justice Walker, in answer to your question, under tab 4 attached to the appellee's brief is the transcript of the receivership hearing. And there are other places in the record that bear this out, but you had asked whether Skull Creek was a single asset corporation and whether the property was its only asset. And Mr. Stovall stated to the court in the hearing on page 9 that is the case. Skull Creek is a single asset entity. And I believe the record is uncontroverted that the only asset of Skull Creek is the 25-acre property. Your Honors, ordinarily, I would not start my argument off with waiver arguments. I'd go straight to the merits, but I think the waiver arguments in this case are so compelling that it's hard for me to avoid doing that. This case presents, I believe, one of the best illustrations of why we have preservation of error rules in civil cases that prevent parties from laying behind the log and raising complaints for the first time on appeal. If you look again at tab 4, the transcript of the hearing, you'll see that not one of the complaints the appellants raised in this appeal regarding the capacity, or what I call capacity, what Mr. Stovall calls standing, that's not raised. The argument that a receivership under the circumstances of this type of case, that was not raised before Judge Fosdell, nor was the complaint that they bring here now about the scope of the receivership order, including more than the 4 acres on which the well sits. The only objections that the appellants raised in the trial court was that Mr. Kelly's individual bankruptcy stayed the proceeding, and that has apparently been abandoned by the appellants after they've apparently recognized that that had no merit. So we believe that they've waived at least those three arguments that they made under the first two points in their brief. Now, they say that they had no ability to oppose the receivership before because of the bankruptcy, but that really, I think, begs the question or misses the point. Whatever the appellants might have believed about the effect that the bankruptcy stay had on the receivership proceeding, they still had the burden, we believe, to bring their objections to the receivership proceeding to Judge Fosdell's attention after he overruled their objection to his proceeding on the basis of their stay argument. They may have been mistaken about, excuse me, Your Honor. Mr. Kelly, who was originally a party, who is the sole owner of Skull Creek Corporation. He also is the sole owner of the general partner of the XR5 partnership, Wisetail Inc. He went on into bankruptcy or filed bankruptcy the morning of the receivership hearing. The appellees non-suited him and then went forward. We didn't point this out in our briefs, but I think it's worth the court noting that on pages 19 through 22 of the transcript, after Mr. Stovall stated that the appellants had no ability to oppose the receivership, he made two objections. One was to a statement made by Mr. Miller, one of the appellee's trial counsel, about Mr. Kelly's voting interest in the XR5 partnership. And he objected and engaged in some argument regarding whether there was a deadlock as to who had control over XR5, which was another basis for the appellees asking the court for a receivership as opposed to other possible remedies. So our view is if counsel was free to make these objections, appellees were certainly free to raise other objections regarding the scope, propriety, and capacity of the appellees to bring this suit.
On the record did they represent, they appeared for at this hearing?
Well, it's at one point in the hearing, Judge McCoy, Mr. Stovall seems to be speaking on behalf of Mr. Kelly.
I mean, at the beginning but of the hearing, Mr. Stovall.
He appeared on behalf of the appellants. He appeared on behalf of all appellants. Yes, Your Honor. We also believe that complaint that the evidence is insufficient to support the requirements of Section 11404 of the Business Organizations Code, that appellants are stopped from bringing that complaint under the invited error doctrine. I know the members of this panel know very well that in a bench trial, you can raise for the first time complaints regarding legal and factual sufficiency of the evidence. However, under the authorities that we cited on page 10 of our brief, that's not the case when a party comes to the trial court and takes the opposite position and contends that either the evidence is sufficient or that no evidence or no additional evidence is necessary to be taken. Under the invited error doctrine, in other words, a party can't come into court, say the evidence, there's no need to take evidence on this, Your Honor, and then come up here before this court, say King's X, the evidence is insufficient. But that's exactly what the appellants did in this case. If you'll look at page 12, I believe, of the transcript of the hearing.
Well, just a
minute. Yes, sir.
I'm on this, just doing it for a show, okay? Mm-hmm. I'm on that. But if he were correct that he didn't have any ability to put on an opposition, I don't see how he's saying we don't think any evidence needs to be presented. It seems like he's just saying if you want to put it on by affidavit or something, you don't need to call witnesses. I wasn't there. That's kind of what I perceived was going on. I can't do anything. You don't need to call witnesses. Just do it by affidavit.
I think that's perhaps precisely what counsel meant. Because earlier in the hearing, the appellees told Judge Vostell, we have three witnesses that we have here ready to give live testimony, and we also have affidavits, and they asked Judge Vostell, how would you like us to proceed? Judge Vostell says, I'd like to hear live.
Right.
And then counsel for appellees interjects with the objection to proceeding and then ends up with that dialogue that you just referred to, Judge McCoy. Our position is this, that we were prepared to put on witnesses that would have testified perhaps more fully than what the affidavits themselves presented. For the appellees to say, Your Honor, to protest that, to say, Your Honor, there's no point in doing that, no point in putting on a show, we believe that the appellants have put themselves in a position where they took a different position in the trial court than they're taking here, which is there was a need for more evidence to be presented to the trial court for the trial court to properly grant this receivership application.
You don't think they were talking about the character of the evidence as opposed to the substance of the evidence, form of the evidence, live? What happened after? I thought I read where Fostell said something like, call them live.
Well, that was before. That was at the top of the hearing. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Now, he said, call him live. I want to hear him live. Mr. Stovall makes his objections and then ends up with that statement. And then if you'll follow from there and read the dialogue between the court and, I believe, appellee's counsel, I think you'll see that it's clear that both the court and counsel for appellees were led or misled to believe that appellants were satisfied with the affidavits that were presented to the court. it just appears to me, Your Honors, that the appellants want it both ways, and we would just ask that you not let them have it both ways and that you hold that they're stopped from complaining of the sufficiency of the evidence to support the receivership. But assuming that you do decide to reach the merits, we believe there's ample evidence in the record consisting primarily of the affidavits of Jennifer Sprouse, Kent Madden. These are affidavits attached as exhibits to the to Volume 3 of the transcript. We believe those affidavits and the documents attached to those affidavits provided sufficient support for Judge Fostell to make the decision that he did. Well, I think that's a good argument, but I actually think it's a misnomer to say that this is a standing issue versus a capacity. The statute says if you're a member, creditor, some other, or if it's the type of case that equity would, yeah. I don't believe that would go to jurisdiction. If the stay had been authentic, if there had been a bankruptcy stay, that certainly would be jurisdictional, but this, I call it a capacity issue, and I think that's waivable.
So what you just said, I'm picking up that Mr. Kelly individually filed for bankruptcy, but an automatic stay had not been entered?
No, if he had not been non-suited from this case,
yes,
then the court would have been stayed from proceeding as to him. But he was not, okay. You know, if you Section 11404, which is the controlling provision here, is I think much more broadly written than the appellants purport that it is. It provides to the trial court, it gives the trial court broad discretion, and that's what I mean. It provides that the trial court may appoint a receiver when it deems it necessary to conserve the property and business that's at stake and to prevent damage to any interested parties, and when there's no other legal remedy that's available. With regard to the legal remedy, Judge McCoy, I think your comment is right on point about the fact that this was an ongoing business. I can't imagine any type of relief that the court could have entered in this type of case that would have been adequate to allow the business to continue operating and so forth. But with regard to, are there circumstances here that justify Judge Fostell in placing a receivership in charge of this XR5 partnership and the well and the property? The uncontroverted evidence shows this, and I'm just summarizing, that the XR5 well was located on the Skull Creek property. The Skull Creek property, which we discussed earlier about being wholly owned by Mr. Kelly, Skull Creek Corporation, I'm sorry. Kelly placed the XR5 partnership through his wholly owned Wisetail Inc. general partner. He placed it in imminent danger of insolvency, ran it into the ground through mismanagement and self-dealing. Bills were not being paid. Liens in the amount of approximately $230,000 were filed on the property that were likely to be foreclosed upon, and foreclosure would have put the well in jeopardy and shut off all of the revenue stream that the XR5 partnership had. So given the record is obviously a modest record, but there is more than sufficient support based on these facts for Judge Fostell to have exercised his discretion and determined that a receivership needed to be placed on this situation. And Your Honor, it's also one thing I just want to point out. There were no findings of fact or conclusions of law made by Judge Fostell. Findings and conclusions were requested but he did not make them. He was not required to, and there's been no complaint in this appeal about his decision not to. All of the facts necessary to support Judge Fosdell's order, as this court knows, are implied in favor of his ruling, and that would include the failure to, or the lack of any other adequate remedy. We pray that the order be affirmed. Thank you.
Is there a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Briefly.
Tell us about waiver, and I wish you would also explain why there was an inability to oppose the receivership when SR5 was not in receivership. I mean, was not in bankruptcy.
Okay.
My bad.
First, what I'd like to do is respond to your earlier request where you asked if I had given you, in my brief at page 21, I do suggest that other remedies were potentially available. As far as going into the specifics of, I don't go that far. I also am not sure that, well.
I got it.
With respect to waiver, I'm going to explain what my thinking was and the basis for my objection and my continuance that I requested. Right when this started, we walk in, the hearing goes off, and I stood up and I make my objection. This is on page 8 of just to anything going forward.
Because?
For a number of reasons. One, it necessarily entails a property of a debtor in bankruptcy. And my take on that is, from my understanding of bankruptcy law, if you are a creditor or if you are somebody who is pursuing an asset of somebody who is a debtor in bankruptcy, then you need to go to the bankruptcy court.
But they're not pursuing it.
Well, they're applying for a receivership that is... Sir? We're talking about, but we're talking about specifically real property, Skull Creek's real property. That's my, I mean, I make my objection throughout the hearing. We're talking about you're trying to impress a receivership over property that belongs 100% to a debtor in bankruptcy.
Okay, I'm
hearing
that.
But Skull Creek wasn't in bankruptcy.
No, but it's the property of a debt. It's owned 100% by the property. It's part of an estate in bankruptcy. It's owned by
Skull Creek's not in bankruptcy.
No.
Kelly's in bankruptcy.
Ray Kelly.
The property's held in Skull Creek's name.
The property is in Skull Creek's name.
So what does that have to do with SR5 and making objections?
And secondly, So there's the one issue of you have the property of a debtor in bankruptcy. Two is, and this is coming from bankruptcy counsel, in order to be able to properly defend, we would like Mr. Kelly to be available, but with bankruptcy counsel. It was my position. He's the only witness I've got. He's the primary witness that I'm going to need, and I didn't want him on the stand, and appellees eliciting testimony. I mean, that's another thing that is going to require bankruptcy permission from the bankruptcy court. I mean, you don't just put somebody under oath and start asking them questions when they're a debtor in bank. I mean, that's a 2004 exam that you're going to have to go and specifically get bankruptcy court permission to be able to do that. So what I said was, we are requesting a continuance. I object to it going forward in light of the bankruptcy issues, and I'm not bankruptcy counsel, but I think bankruptcy is now in play, and we now have an issue here. Let's move for a continuance, and what I said was that I do not have the ability to oppose a receivership at this time. That is not to say that I said, well, we agree to it. We're ready to sign an agreed order. I'll put it in writing. We're unopposed. I said we do not have the ability to oppose.
Two ways to protect from foreclosure, bankruptcy and receivership. So I'm having a problem understanding why a receivership was such a problem when, one, the property isn't in the name of the debtor in bankruptcy. Two, the debtor in bankruptcy is in bankruptcy to prevent foreclosure. And three, the receivership prevented foreclosure of property that wasn't in his name, but over which he had an interest through the various levels.
I'm not sure I understand how the receivership has prevented a foreclosure on...
You can't foreclose on property that has a receiver.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you think you need to flesh out your reasoning on bankruptcy? Because it sounds like what you're really saying is that the trial court abused its discretion in not granting you a continuance because it couldn't proceed under these circumstances with Mr. Kelly in bankruptcy.
No, Your Honor, I don't. And what? And can I explain briefly why?
In 1 minute.
I'll give you. Okay. The reason is because none of that is. It almost doesn't matter what I said at this hearing. What if I hadn't shown up at all? Does that relieve them of their obligation to comply with the mandatory requirements that are set?
If you hadn't shown up, they would have put on live testimony.
Okay, and they still could have. The best part about the waiver argument and what Mr. Boyd, who was counsel for the appellees, understood what I was saying. He understood. The court understood what I was saying. Immediately after I made my objection and said we do not have the ability. After making my objection, moving for continuance, he said, fine, we're offered to go forward. We're prepared to go forward to present the proof in written form. And that's page 12. The court said, fine, let's go forward with the hearing. So
okay. Thank you.
It's their burden. Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted. We do appreciate your coming in.
Thank you, Your Honor.